This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, it's Cassie Huff with you for The Country Hour across South Australia and Broken Hill. Well, it's been a long slog, but finally the election is over and we can get on with the running of the country. You're not just deciding who is going to run it, but soon I'll have a bit of a look at some of the factors going forward. What's going to affect regional Australia, in particular South Australia, in terms of Labor's policy going forward. Also, we've had our election, but in Fiji, they are getting ready to have their say on who will run their country. About 4,000 Fijians are here in Australia, so the Fijian Government Election Committee is travelling across Australia to update the electoral roll.
Right across the country, I think they're just under 4,000, I believe, in the long term, which is the sort of the Pacific Labor Scheme and the seasonal worker, which is short term. They're a growing number.
So there's a lot of the workers here. We'll take a look at just how important it is to their country to have an accurate vote from the large number. They said 4,000 or 5,000 people in this country now, and the effect that will have on their election. But look at an issue before we get into the election stuff. We'll look at an issue that is very important to agriculture, and that is what is happening in Indonesia with these issues around biosecurity, lumpy skin disease and foot and mouth disease. Troy Setter is the head of the Consolidated Pastoral Company, which owns several cattle stations across northern Australia. It also runs two feedlots in Indonesia, and Troy has been in Indonesia over the last 2 weeks as the country grapples with these lumpy skin disease and foot and mouth disease outbreaks. He told Matt Brown that while Indonesia is doing its best, these diseases continue to spread.
It's certainly a challenging time for Indonesia with two pretty strong exotic diseases in lumpy skin and foot and mouth. Foot and mouth has rapidly spread in the last few weeks. It's now throughout Java, Sumatra, Kalimantan. There's reports of it in Sulawesi, and it's also been found in Lombok, which is on the eastern side of Bali. So it's well spread across all the major islands in Indonesia.
What about your own operations there in Indonesia? How are things going?
Look, pretty good. We had good biosecurity for many years, but we've really enhanced that with lumpy skin disease, and now we've enhanced it even more with foot and mouth. Lumpy skin was predominantly spread by vectors and also some contact, but not through soil, where foot and mouth disease can be spread in multiple forms, but particularly by soil, infected animals, feed, and also can be wind spread over shorter distances. So we know that it's very close to our feedlot in Medan. Medan's just across from Singapore and KL, to give people a bit of geographic, and then our bigger feedlot in Lampung. It's the bottom end of Sumatra. We know it's very close there as well.
Have you got a sense of what it would mean to your operations if foot and mouth disease gets found close by?
Look, for us, it'd be pretty concerning. I think one thing that's not really being reported on up here is that the foot and mouth disease is also in sheep, goats and pigs, but there's a very strong focus on cattle. We have a large number of our team up here have goats and a few have cattle at home. So if it was to get even closer in our region, the chance of our team accidentally bringing it into work on clothing and footwear is absolutely real, or it blowing in. So we've dramatically increased the biosecurity and washing and cleanliness of every person going in and out, and every truck going in and out of the feedlots.
That's what CPC is doing. What about the Indonesian government? What's happening over there at the moment to try and stop or eradicate FMD?
So there's been some movement restrictions put in place for local cattle in some regions, the Indonesian government is working on trying to procure vaccines, we understand. There's still no foot and mouth disease vaccine in the country. There's no lumpy skin vaccine available commercially in Indonesia. There's a small amount available in the Riau province where the first outbreak was, but lumpy skin's sort of fallen off the radar a fair bit. And we're hopeful that that Indonesian government can lift the control measures that they've got in place. The president's been really supportive of stamping out foot and mouth disease, and we know Australia has offered substantial assistance, both physical and technical and economic, to eradicate foot and mouth disease and lumpy skin disease in Indonesia.
Is there any talks of culling, burn and bury, like we've seen other nations do?
No, at this stage there isn't. There's not the predetermined compensation packages and the predetermined veterinary biosecurity plans like Australia and the UK have and other countries have in Indonesia. At this stage, it looks to be a treatment for sick animals and then a prevention program with vaccination and a stamp out through vaccination rather than a stamp out through destroying animals. There's been several campaigns that we've seen on social media and mainstream media to reassure the general public that that meat from previously or currently infected animals is safe for human consumption. And we've seen the agriculture minister come out eating satays and meat and things on TV to reassure people that the meat is safe.
As you say, Indonesia's dealing with two diseases here. Is there one sort of taking precedent in terms of the government focus?
Yeah, FMD, foot and mouth disease, is absolutely taken focus over the top of lumpy skin disease. Indonesia's always valued its foot and mouth disease freedom and is committed to trying to get it back.
But it continues to spread, hey?
Yeah, it continues to spread, looking at the sort of reports over the last 2 weeks that are coming through. Hopefully some vaccine can be sourced and movement restrictions can be more tightly enforced, and that should slow and then hopefully stop its spread.
And just finally, Troy Setter, you've been in the beef game for so long. Where does this situation rate in terms of being worried about the future?
Look, it's pretty high. And Australia's done well to keep foot and mouth disease out from countries, you know, around Australia and where tourists travel. I mean, the foot and mouth is spread well through the world, but it's now very close. It's a lot shorter flight time from Indonesia to Australia. So, you know, it's pretty scary. Lumpy skin disease and its ability to be blown in by cyclones or strong low pressure systems is pretty concerning. If you look at, you know, fall armyworm and the speed that it travelled from Southeast Asia into Australia and keeps coming in is an example of the risks that we face with lumpy skin. So it's pretty concerning. I think the other thing is, if you go back to 10, 15 years ago, about 50% of our red meat production was exportable. Today it's well into the 70s, particularly for beef. So we're just so reliant on those export markets, and just about all of our export protocols for boxed meat and live stock have free from foot and mouth and free from lumpy skin disease as an absolute tight condition in those protocols. So we would be really challenged if we had an outbreak in Australia, and saw some recent modelling that from ABARES that foot and mouth disease would cost Australia about $80 billion if we were to be infected now.
Troy Setter, the CEO of Consolidated Pastoral Company, who is in Indonesia at the moment. You can listen to a longer interview with him on the ABC Rural website, because he has a pretty good oversight of what is happening in Indonesia at the moment with the biosecurity issues, foot and mouth disease and lumpy skin disease. Now, moving away from livestock, though, to an interesting project looking at using biochar as a feed supplement to reduce methane emissions from livestock. Obviously, seaweed's been the sort of standout product in this space, but this biochar is one of the questions that researchers at the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture are investigating as part of a larger project to find ways to make livestock businesses more sustainable. Social researcher at the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture, Nikolai Barnes, explains how they are conducting their trial.
So biochar is a mineral charcoal seed supplement, and we're using a supplement called FeedChar, and it's supposed to have an impact, and some of the research is now pointing to it having an impact on increasing animal health. It can also improve live weight gain in animals. It has an impact on enteric methane emissions as well, and there's suggestions that it can reduce methane by about 10%. There has also been some work done around the idea that carbon content in manure can then be taken up by soil, and so carbon sequestering can happen over time in the soil, and that then also impacts on the entire greenhouse gas emissions that farmers or farms might have. So that's the biochar project. What we're doing at the moment is we have a trial happening on farm in a farm in Deloraine, and that trial is happening and there's experiments being done in all of those areas to see whether the cattle there are improving in weight gain, what their health is like, and soil testing to be able to test carbon levels is all going on. And the modellers that are on the project will be able to model from that what might happen for future farmers if these things are done. In August, we'll have a field day coming up, and what we're wanting is for other farmers to come along and have a look at that trial and see what the results are then. And we'd like to follow them for 12 months and see in 12 months what their experience of using biochar has been as well.
And why biochar?
I think biochar, it's been around for ages. It's got a history of being used in Amazon rainforest. It's something that's used pretty consistently in Europe. So it's just one of those things that in Australia we possibly don't hear a lot about, and so we want to see what it's like, what's going on here as an adaption idea that can be used on farm.
And how are you going to measure if the feed supplement with biochar does contribute to the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions?
The actual emissions measurement is a little bit hard to do. The modellers will be doing a lot of that work. And as the social researcher, I'm not real sure how they do that part of things. But they can do soil testing, and we'll be doing soil testing to see how much carbon is taken up in the soil when the animals are eating the biochar and the manure comes out and it enters the soil. Then they can measure the carbon differences in the soil over time as well.
And so could biochar then, if this trial is successful, be a game changer for the industry?
Possibly not a major game changer, but it's one of those things that we're trying to see whether it can be a small part or contributor to the overall gas emissions. So the project actually does quite a few other adaption trials as well. So we're looking at four different ideas within the entire Nexus project. So there's things like what we've called low-hanging fruit. So they're just simple and reversible ideas such as lambing and calving dates so that you can match up feed supplies on your farm, adapting pasture species so that increased root depth can happen and carbon sequestering can happen into the soil. So they're sort of really simple things, and biochar is another one of those nice simple things that farmers can just pick up tomorrow and run with. But they're also having a look at ideas of ways to be able to become carbon neutral on farm. And they're things like total pasture renovations. There's a vaccine out that they're trialling as well that can be given to animals to reduce their enteric methane emissions. And so they're the other types of things that farmers might be able to pick up on. There's also things like income diversification that they're exploring, which are bigger ideas, such as putting in a vineyard on your farm. But those ideas then come with a lot of implications for farmers. And then we're also having a look at a stacked idea. So taking the low-hanging fruit, all those ideas about becoming carbon neutral, and the ideas about income diversification, and putting them all together to see whether we can impact in big ways for adapting to climate change and for greenhouse reduction.
Nicolai Barnes, a social researcher at the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture, speaking with Jessica Schremer. It's coming up to 20 past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
weather next, but in the meantime, Australia's election might be run and done, but across the Pacific, Fijians are getting ready to have their say on who will run their country. About 4,000 Fijians are here in Australia, or as part of the Pacific Island Worker Program, and the Pacific Island Council of Australia's Takini Tavui tells Eliza Berlage the Fijian government's election commission has been travelling across Australia to update their electoral roll.
This is not the first time that they've done this. They did it in the previous election as well. And that was predominantly focused on the diaspora right across the whole country, all states, territories and main cities particularly. But now certainly there's a huge focus on the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme workers, the PALM scheme workers, who are scattered right across the country. And so PICSA is providing support there, I guess, in our role as one of the contracted bodies by DFAT to provide support for the seasonal workers and Pacific Labour Scheme. So we're able to provide some support to the Fiji elections to get their workers registered.
How does that all work? So you have officers coming out to locations like the Riverland. What do they do?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. So we picked them up on Friday from the Adelaide airport, took them over to Bordertown was the first stop. We've got some workers there for JBS abattoirs, and then we went across over to Narra Court, T's abattoirs there. I've got some of the Fijians there. And then after that, we went to Paringa Riverland, but we also did a stopover at Mildura. We've got a group of workers there that have personally requested our attendance. So we'll be heading there. We headed there as well. And met those workers, got them registered, and then made our way over to Paringa. And then after Paringa, which was a Saturday night, we then headed over to Adelaide on Sunday and had a session over at the Port Adelaide Rugby Club.
For Australians, you can, of course, update and enrol online, but is this available for Fijians?
No, unfortunately. That would have been much easier because the Fiji election office are having quite a difficult time trying to identify all the locations where the workers are, the diaspora, and not having that data available to them obviously creates a lot of challenges. So they're really just working on the small number of information and data they've collected. But certainly having it online would have made life easier for everybody. But unfortunately, that's not the case.
And any idea at the moment how many Fijians are in Australia, or at least in South Australia, for the Pacific Islander and foreign worker programs?
Well, right across the country, I think they're just under 4,000, I believe, in the long term, which is the sort of the Pacific Labour Scheme and the seasonal worker, which is short term. They're a growing number. I'm aware that flights are arriving from Fiji and other Pacific Island countries as well, but it's almost like every fortnight they've got groups that are being deployed right across the country. But I think it'd be creeping up to 5,000 fairly soon.
When will Fijians be going to the polls?
That's in about a month and a half. I think this morning I found out that it's could potentially be delayed, but that's the plan at the moment. That's what's been announced.
Seems like never-ending elections. Pacific Island Council of South Australia, Takini Tavui, speaking with Eliza Berlage. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, because there seems to be a rather significant system forming off the coast of, the Indian Ocean, making its way across South Australia, that hopefully will have implications for farmers looking for rain. But Senior Forecaster Hannah Marsh can explain more. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
What are you seeing?
Yeah, so essentially the high pressure system that's dominated our weather and is to an extent still today will move out to the east very slowly, but we do have a low pressure trough which will develop over the far west of the state tomorrow. It's going to gradually move over the remainder of the state mid to late next in the week. But associated with that, as you mentioned, we are seeing some infeed of moisture ahead of that. So we'll start seeing the shower activity in the west of the state, west of about Fowler's Bay today. There is the chance of seeing some thunderstorms with that in the far west of the state. But we are looking at dry conditions for the remainder of the state today. We've got generally mild to warm temperatures, and the winds are moderate northeast to northerly. With this system, as it does approach, we are looking at the winds becoming fresh at times, particularly in the west. Then as we move into tomorrow, the moisture is gradually going to move to the east. So we're looking at showers initially in the west. They'll gradually extend to towards Port Augusta to Kingscote by evening. And same with the thunderstorms. We're expecting them in the west to begin with, roughly reaching Cooper Pedy to Port Lincoln by evening. They will also be quite gusty as well, so there is the chance of some stronger winds and also quite gusty winds as well, and the potential for some heavier falls, particularly with the thunderstorms, but also just with the showers, particularly about the west coast on Tuesday, even extending into the northwest pastoral district. But then as we move into Wednesday, the weather continues to move out to the east. We're looking at the showers really throughout the agricultural area, extending into the south of the pastoral districts, and possibly even is extending up towards Cooper Pedy and Moomba. The thunderstorm activity on Wednesday should be confined to western parts of the agricultural area, adjacent parts of the West Coast District, and the southern parts of the Northwest Pastoral District as well. And similarly, we are looking at seeing the potential for some damaging winds in with the thunderstorms, and the potential for some heavier falls. It will be more confined to Eyre Peninsula and also the Mount Lofty Ranges south of about the Barossa for Wednesday. Then on Thursday, that weather does move out to the east and we start seeing the showers easing, but not entirely clearing. So for the peak of the shower activity, we are looking at Tuesday in the west and Wednesday about central and eastern parts. In terms of rainfall totals, we're generally looking at 1 to 5 millimetres, increasing to 5 to 15 millimetres over the agricultural area and also in the west. We're looking at isolated falls of 15 to 30 millimetres about the west coast district, southern parts of the northwest pastoral district, and the Mount Lofty Ranges south of the Barossa Valley. And there is also the potential for falls of 30 to 50 millimetres with those heavier showers and also with thunderstorms.
So it's pretty widespread by the sounds of that then.
Yeah, there will be isolated areas with higher falls, but in terms of that potential for 15 to 30 millimetres, we are looking at that being, widespread.
Fingers crossed. Although quite quick moving, it looks like really it's all over and done by the end of Wednesday, moves across the state.
Yeah, it will be pretty quick moving, mainly Tuesday, Wednesday, but it is looking like shower activity will continue, be much lighter from Thursday to Saturday. Then we've got a new system that will move in on Sunday and into Monday, which will bring cooler air, some more unstable air, and also the return of some shower activity.
And this is all coming as Queensland's obviously seen a lot of rain, and now you're reporting some flooding in the Diamantina River. How much water is expected there?
Yeah, so we're looking at, we do have an initial flood warning for the inland rivers in the northeast, and we're looking at high flows with the potential for river flooding occurring along the Diamantina between Birdsville and the Goyder Lagoons.
Well, thanks so much for that insight. It might get exacerbated if there's a lot of rain in the north, although it does sound like this rainfall band is going to be a bit more southern than some of the other ones that have been coming across the state recently.
Yeah, the next system, Sunday, Monday, will be the one to watch for the northeast, but definitely the rainfall further south for this system.
Yeah, it's probably the first decent look that some areas have had, so hopefully it comes off. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Hannah Marsh there, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, it'll be mostly sunny tomorrow. Bit of wind around. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 8 and 11 degrees, but the day is rather warm, getting to the low 20s. The lower western will be sunny. There the overnight temperatures will drop down to about 7 degrees, but again, some pretty mild daytime temperatures reaching into the low 20s. So I'm Cassie Huff. This is the Country Hour. In the next half hour, we're going to take a bit of a look at what the election has meant for South Australian agriculture. We'll catch up with Primary Producers SA to hear their take on what has happened with the election, as it is coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hello, it's great to have your company. And we've been talking live exports, ag visa, climate change, all sorts of things. And farming lobby groups around Australia are now taking stock of the federal election result and analysing the new Labor government's election promises. I'll have a chat with Primary Producers SA Chair about what the next 3 years could hold for rural South Australians. And it seems climate change has really been a focus of this election. It's been dubbed the climate election.
I think in many parts of the bush, we saw candidates coming for the first time with a strong climate platform and getting big swings.
I'll have more on that soon, but first we'll find out what's making news with Emma Ribellato. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. The new Prime Minister is preparing to leave the country just hours after being sworn in. Anthony Albanese and Foreign Minister Penny Wong will be flying to Japan later today for a meeting of the Quad Leaders Forum. The Labor caucus will meet next Tuesday to decide the full ministry. In South Australia, all eyes remain on the seat of Sturt and in the Senate, where the Greens are likely to take the fifth spot and One Nation is still ahead for the sixth seat. Former Channel 7 presenter Andrew O'Keefe has been granted bail on condition he check into a drug and alcohol rehab facility straight away. The 50-year-old has faced the New South Wales Supreme Court today. The ex-game show host has pleaded not guilty to five charges after allegedly assaulting a woman at his city apartment in January. And Russia has lost the right to hold this year's FINA World Swimming 25-metre Championships. Instead, the short course event will be held in Melbourne. Up to 2,500 swimmers and officials will be there in front of an expected 60,000 fans in December. We'll have more news at 1.
Thanks for that, Emma. Now, the seemingly endless election campaigns have drawn to an end with what looks to be a Labor victory to join a state Labor victory in South Australia. There's still some counting going on, but we'll keep following that. So from live exports, the ag visa and the ubiquitous climate change, what does a Labor government mean for South Australian farmers? Primary Producers SA Chair Simon Maddox will try to answer that question. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cass.
What does a Labor government mean for agriculture in South Australia?
With any government, there are opportunities and possible challenges. I think the important thing is we have certainty after both a state election and a federal election now as to who we are dealing with and what their policies are going to be. So that's very helpful for us in terms of forward planning. Clearly, there's been a shift nationally. I think the electorate has given whoever was going to form government a very clear message. They want a greater focus on climate change and climate adaptation and, you know, addressing key targets. And that no doubt will have consequences that may impact on agriculture. On the other hand, you know, part of our message and our work with the National Farmers Federation has to continue to push the fact that farmers are very committed environmental stewards. And I think we would hope that there's greater recognition in this process given to the work that farmers have been doing in embracing sustainable environmental management. And, you know, farmers are dealing with climate variability every single day. So I think there are some positive opportunities there for agriculture to be recognised for what it does do already positively. There are some challenges that the Labor Party committed to in going to the election, that they would, for example, phase out live sheep exports, but we don't know what the timeframe for that might be. On the flip side of that, they are committed to long-term sustainable funding to strengthen Australia's biosecurity system. And right at the moment, with Japanese encephalitis having gone through the country and with foot and mouth outbreak and lumpy skin outbreaks in Indonesia on our doorstep, obviously biosecurity is a very challenging area, and the sooner we get some committed sustainable funding into strengthening our biosecurity systems and response teams, I think the better.
It's yet to be seen how much influence the independents will have in this government that's about to be formed, but one issue that came through quite a lot, as you've mentioned, is the climate change initiatives and greenhouse gas emissions. And one of the issues raised was, or numbers thrown around, was about $10 billion in fossil fuel subsidies that those candidates wanted addressed, and $8 billion of those subsidies covers the fuel tax credit, which affects industries like mining and agriculture, etc. How much concern is there that these subsidies that are important to regional Australians could be targeted?
Yeah, look, I think they're very real concerns. I think the strong message we've been pushing back, though, is we need to be very clear that the fuel tax credit is not a subsidy. Just as businesses that have to pay GST on inputs that they subsequently onsell can get a rebate for GST, the fuel tax credit doesn't reduce the price of fuel to producers. It allows you to claim back a credit on the fuel tax that was paid where that fuel is used off-road for driving business like farming. And in fact, even the Greens, I think, came out and indicated that they would support retaining the fuel tax credit for agriculture, not necessarily for other industries. So I think, you know, our push will be we've got to stop letting people call it a subsidy. It's an input tax credit on a production business. If we've seen anything through COVID, it's the fact that Australians come to realise how critical it is to have quality food available, sustainably produced locally. And these are the sort of things, with global supply chains being so disrupted at the moment, we're going to see input costs going up everywhere. The last thing we need is to have some of those other issues added onto that very challenging space already. But my strong message is we've got to recognise it's a tax credit, it's not a subsidy.
Part of playing into that is COVID and the reduced workforce that has been around for a long time but has certainly become acute in the last few years. The agriculture visa was developed with the National Farmers Federation, but Labor has said that it would make changes to that, that they would build on the existing PALM scheme, the Pacific Islands scheme. How much of an effect would changes to the ag visa have, do you think, on the availability of workers to South Australian farmers?
Well, I think we all recognise that with international border restrictions during COVID, the supply of seasonal workforce has been decimated, and that's impacted many industries, including many of those in South Australia that require seasonal workers to pick fruit and harvest grapes and things like that. Yes, there is a concern. Labor has said that they would scrap the ag visa in its current form. Their proposal was to move to increase, uncap the Pacific Labor Scheme and allow them to bring families, which might mean a more stable supply of Pacific Island workers. I think there's more work for us to do in this space in understanding what the government's concerns were with the ag visa versus what we need to achieve. I note at the same time that Labor committed going into the election a need to build greater trade relationships with a number of Asian countries to our north, like Vietnam. And I know that's been another area of critical workforce supply potential. So I think there's an area for ongoing negotiation as to what is required to fill the seasonal worker gaps and where the best countries are to source the required labour from, and then what do we need to do to facilitate that. So probably work in progress there.
There's also been a lot of commentary around the Murray-Darling Basin plan, and with a state Labor government also saying that buybacks could be an option explored if the 450 gigalitres of additional environmental water on top of the basin plan isn't reached. Now you've got a federal government that is looking to recover that extra 450 gigalitres as well, but hasn't really detailed how they will go about that. With there being two layers of government now in South Australia with the stated aims in this area, how do you think that is going to affect the relationship with the other states in this area?
Look, I think we all appreciate that the Murray, we need to see appropriate environmental flows down the Murray that facilitate the lower reaches of the Murray, and we're on the receiving end of everything upstream. So I think we all understand the need for the environmental flow to be delivered. Obviously, it will challenge colleagues upriver, because if the buybacks are going to be delivered for the 450 gigalitres mandated, they're probably largely going to come from upstream irrigators and others, and I have no doubt that will create some tension in the discourse between states. But, you know, we've just got to land on a reasonable position and assume that there'll be a rational process to engage how those buybacks are facilitated. I haven't heard anybody saying they don't want to back in the existing Murray-Darling Basin plan. And obviously there's the recommendations from the South Australian Royal Commission into this area that would obviously be forefront of any local engagement. So I think we're in for some interesting times in discussing water, both nationally, and, you know, it's going to be a big issue for us in our own state in terms of locally managing, particularly in the southeast, the various demands being placed on water supplies there. So I think water is going to be a big issue both federally and at a state level over the next 12 to 18 months.
Speaking to Primary Producers SA Chair Simon Maddox. Now, we don't yet know who will form the new cabinet and who will be the Minister for Agriculture for Australia. Julie Collins was the shadow agriculture spokesperson for Labor. Whether or not she continues in that role is yet to be seen. Do you have a preference or a particular member that you would be keen to work with in this space?
No, I'm not going to speculate on who they think should carry that portfolio. I just hope that whoever gets to carry that portfolio can be recognised both personally and professionally within Cabinet as representing the significance of this area to Australia's future growth and development. We know in South Australia, primary industries are the backbone of our state economy. And as much as we talk up the great opportunities through other areas of development, such as defence and space and other things, the pragmatic reality is that our state's economic base is totally dependent upon primary production and primary industries. And even nationally, these are critically important industries for Australia's growth, development and for regional communities. We know the health of regional communities is intimately related to the health of the primary production sector. So I just hope that we end up with someone who is both passionate, committed and carries the level of significance into Cabinet to make sure that the issues are appropriately heard and engaged within Cabinet discussions going forward at a national level.
Well, we'll know who it is soon. Thank you so much for your thoughts today.
My thanks, Cassie.
Professor Simon Maddox, Chair of Primary Producers SA, with some of his thoughts from a South Australian farming perspective. Now, as I was saying, it has been billed a climate election with inner city independents running on a platform of climate change action, and that decimated the Liberal vote in some areas. But what changes will the new government make to rules around, say, carbon farming, renewables and mining, and how could that affect rural communities? Michael Condon put these questions to the Climate Council's CEO, Amanda McKenzie.
Well, the Labor Party does have carbon farming as part of their platform as well. So I'm sure that within what they've described so far, that agriculture will still be an important part of what the platform involves. What's different is that what they've indicated is there'd be much stronger investment in renewable energy, in batteries, in EVs and in manufacturing, green manufacturing. So that's clean steel, clean concrete, other products that we could be making in Australia with very cheap renewable energy that could be new export industries for Australia.
Because in terms of the coalition, they would put a lot of eggs into that soil carbon basket, and we've had some mm-hmm. scientists that were saying they probably over-egged the custard a bit too much there because it was it wasn't possible to have productive agriculture as well.
Yeah, well, I think the common pattern in the coalition's policy was that there was no real commitment to getting emissions down, and there was a bit of window dressing, and it was, there was real heads in the sand on climate and not preparing for the type of extreme weather events that we have now sadly seen in the Northern Rivers or Southeast Queensland, the bushfires, etc. So I think what the election says to me is that people are really concerned about the impacts of climate change that they're experiencing now, and they want action that is going to protect communities and set Australia up for the 21st century. So renewable energy is a winner, sustainable transport is a winner, clean manufacturing is a winner. So there's lots of things in which we can be setting ourselves up for the future and also importantly preparing for the worsening extreme weather events that unfortunately we're now seeing.
What about the coal industry? Are those jobs in the coal industry in regional areas, are they safe or under more threat now? What's your assessment of that?
What's really important, and I think what communities are really aware of in those areas, is that there needs to be solutions for the future, and there needs to be a properly set up transition body that can be supporting communities in that transition. So there will be jobs lost in the coal industry that is happening anyway. Coal in Australia, our coal-fired generators are all ageing, they're inefficient. Renewable energy is the clean source of power, so that's where the market is already moving. The important thing to note in terms of jobs is that climate change is already having a really big impact on jobs. So we need to be balancing our thinking about jobs. Where are the new jobs that can be created with new industries? And those coal communities are often really well situated for opportunities. So the Latrobe Valley, for instance, which has been historically a coal area, they've got the transmission lines. If you can set up wind power, renewable energy, batteries, that could be a hub for renewable energy well into the future. So replacing energy jobs with other energy jobs.
But that's going to be very costly, isn't it? That's a big infrastructure ask, and we're talking billions and billions of dollars to do that.
Well, there are billions and billions of dollars of private investment that can come with proper policies that are set up. So already in New South Wales...
Well, a subsidy, you mean?
Well, there's different things that can be done. In New South Wales, the Liberal National Government has brought in place renewable energy zones. So that's just getting the policy settings right. It doesn't need incentives to then attract private investment. So if you can say, and, you know, private investment can be there for transmission lines, it's there for renewable power plants, it's there for transport. There's a whole range of ways. It's just about getting the settings right to encourage that private investment to flow in. So saying, yes, you can build in these regions. So changing the planning infrastructure, for instance, to enable companies to do that.
And yet when we look at the regional electorates, maybe that, you know, those arguments about renewables and climate change and those arguments maybe didn't cut through because we saw the Nationals hold on to all their seats?
Yeah, we certainly did see the Nationals hold on to all their seats. What really struck me, though, was that in many of those areas where there was a pro-climate independent, because that wasn't in all of the seats, but there was in some, particularly in areas that were affected by the floods. So Cowper, for instance, in northern New South Wales, northeastern New South Wales, was affected by the flooding and fires recently, and they had a 25% swing towards a primary vote to an independent who had a climate platform. In Nichols in northern Victoria, there was a 25% swing towards an independent with strong climate policies. And in Gilmore on the south coast of New South Wales, and heavily affected by Black Summer, there was a 12% swing to a Liberal candidate, Andrew Constance, who's been a very vocal supporter of a strong climate platform. So I think in many parts of the bush, we saw candidates coming for the first time with a strong climate platform and getting big swings. They might not have knocked out the sitting national candidate, but they're going to give them a really clear run for their money next time. Because like in Nichols, for instance, that really ate into the Nationals. The Nationals lead in that area. Same with Cowper, that's still on the not quite decided yet whether that's going to be a Nationals or whether it's going to be this new climate independent.
Climate Council CEO Amanda McKenzie speaking to Michael Condon there. It's 13 minutes to one.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
To agribusiness now, and a perfect storm of factors has seen the Adelaide-based agribusiness Elders return some strong half-year results. Historic livestock prices, high property prices and favourable conditions have seen an 80% growth in the before-tax profit of the company. And it's also meant a jump in shares this morning when this half-year result was announced. To explain what's going on, Managing Director Mark Allison joins me. Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So what's been the main driver of this growth?
Well, I think we've all noted the strong ag conditions around the country, in most areas of the country, and that's been a great backdrop, both in summer crop, winter crop, livestock, you know, sheep prices, and cattle prices. So that's a part. In our work, it's about just over 40% of the result is from that seasonal uplift, and the rest of it, the 58%, is around from through a bunch of other initiatives that we put in place with our 8-point plan, which is around our backward integration strategy, our bolt-on acquisition strategy, the efficiency strategies. We've appointed somewhere in the close to 300 people have joined the business between last year and today. So there have been lots of initiatives, but we're really doing what people tend to do in regional rural Australia, and getting on with it and taking advantage of the good conditions. And setting yourself up for when conditions aren't as good later on.
Input costs, though, are very high, and your company's a main seller of inputs like fertiliser and chemical and things like this. Could these strong results be seen as gouging, though, of farmers?
No, well, I don't think so. I mean, in terms of the input costs, and particularly some of the herbicides, I mean, glyphosate, the classic, I mean, there has been shortages around the world, and that's the cost that we're receiving them at. And in fact, across our fertiliser business, with increasing cost of fertilisers. Our margins have gone down through that period due to the higher cost, but it doesn't take away from the negative impact of high input costs. But from our viewpoint, we're not a base manufacturer, so we're buying and selling, and we've been trying to do what we can do to order well, buy well, in order to make it as economic as possible.
You just mentioned that you're looking at some acquisitions. I understand that there's quite a few on the cards, but go back 10, 15 years or so, 10 years ago, Elders was really offloading a lot of companies that had been bought up. What's driven this change in approach to go back to bringing in new companies?
Yeah, I think it's a great question because I think around that time I'd just joined the Elders board as a non-exec director and then I became chairman a little while after that. And I think the market cap of Elders in that time was around 50 million. And I think today it's up to 2.3 billion because of the disciplined approach to the 8-point plan. So we back then, we said what we were going to do differently was to focus on our core business, which is agriculture. Elders has been in rural regional Australia for 183 years. We've grown with Australian agriculture, Australian agribusiness. And I think when we got back to doing what we do best, which is supporting our clients and rural communities, things changed significantly. In fact, I was at Elders is a partner of the Royal Flying Doctors in South Oz, and I was at the Gala Ball on Saturday night and just looking at all the wonderful contributions that that they've made and we've made beside them throughout the history, Australian agribusiness history. It's just wonderful. And we're now, to answer your question, we're now at a point where we can reinvest, we can buy a business. These acquisitions are all ag services businesses, so it's all core business, nothing off or adjacent or away from what we do best.
How long do you see these good times that you've referred to lasting for?
Well, I think the good times, seasonal conditions are seasonal conditions. This is how agriculture works. But if you look at the base fundamentals, we went backwards. We had the target of 100 billion by 2030 in terms of pre-farm gate production. It started at 60, went back to 45 during the East Coast drought, and now we're close to 80 or maybe above that. I think that the core fundamentals of Australian agriculture are very, very positive. If we look at the seasonal conditions, if we look at the cycles, the global commodity markets, an upshot of the Ukrainian conflict is pressure on commodity prices, which as a result has high wheat barley prices globally. Cattle prices look like they're going to continue for time into the future. So I'm thinking it's probably 18 months to 2 years, maybe even 3 years. In northern Australia, it remains very positive with water storage in dams. So I think it is positive.
For anyone investing in Elders, what difference will this half-year result make for the final EBIT guidance going forward for the final year results?
Yeah, so we in our 8-point plans, we've been committing to 5 to 10% growth through the cycles, growth of earnings per share and EBIT. And we did that after we talked to our investors. The view was that ag stocks are notorious for being cyclical. And we wanted to take this that seasonality out of Elders, which we've done by dropping the cost and capital base. So we've grown consistently throughout all the 8-point plan periods. For the first half, it's been quite strong. Our sense is that in the second half, we've reset our guidance. So we've upgraded to, we were saying 20 to 30% up on last year. Now we're saying 30 to 40% up on last year. And I think that just sets the business up very, very well.
Some pretty strong results to take into the boardroom. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Kathy.
Bye. That was a very upbeat Mark Allison, the Managing Director of Elders there. Finally today, I don't know if you're like and you go on a long road trip, do you buy maybe some jerky to chew on or perhaps a bag of lollies? I'm a bit guilty of that. I also like ice cream as well. But how would you feel about eating an alternative to those products made from Australian-grown seaweed? After 4 years and a lot of trial and error, West Australian seaweed farmer Ash Sutton is about to launch two chewing products made from seaweed as a healthier snack option. Rural reporter Joe Prendergast recently visited Ash at a shack he calls home at the Abrolhos Islands off the Geraldton coast.
You want to smack some or?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Have a taste.
About that much?
Yeah, rip it off, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's got a, like a...
It's like a red lolly.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, eh?
Mm.
And then it's good texture.
And there's nothing artificial in that?
Nothing, mate.
Oh, my God.
Mm. Yeah, and it has some unique properties, which appeal to me. And
what are they?
When I do my little techniques with it, it has a very elastic sort of feel to it, and hence I thought, shit, this will be good in a little chewing snack and to target the confectionery market as well as the chef's table.
And that is what you're going for. You were saying earlier that you really want to have seaweed as an alternative to lollies.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've spent the last 4 to 5 years growing about 8 varieties of seaweed out here. It's not very easy to grow it, especially some of the varieties, because the water temperatures change, you get cold fronts come in that wipe out all your crop, so it's pretty tricky. So this particular product lasted the longest for me, and I thought, well, I'm running out of checkbooks, so I've got to stick to one product. This is the one I've worked out how to grow, therefore this has got the unique properties, which when I do my little tricks with it, it's exactly the same consistency as a snake, you know, like a little lolly snake. Yeah, yeah. Or a lolly gummy bear. Do you know what I mean? And it's such a cool looking product. I thought, I won't refine it, I won't process it, and wouldn't it be good if that actually tasted like a lolly? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's got a bit of honey. I didn't want to use sugar. I know that the vegans won't like me because they don't eat honey, but it's got a little bit of honey from my farm in Greenock.
And there's a few other tricks to get it to look like that.
Yeah,
but there that's is. Your IP, isn't it? You're not going to divulge those secrets.
No, that's 4 years and a lot of checkbooks.
Yeah. What variety is that you're growing?
It's a Spinosium, so it's a red algae. Yeah, so it's a red seaweed, basically.
Why did you choose to grow seaweed at the Abrolhos?
Abrolhos is pretty much, I live in Western Australia, so the particular type of seaweed I wanted to grow has a warmer water variety, and the Abrolhos Islands is in direct path of the Leeuwin Current, so it has a good temperature range for the type of seaweed, hence, yeah. And the Abrolhos Islands is, I've got a lot of mates here in the commercial fishing industry, and yeah, spend a lot of time growing up here and
sort of like coming home almost.
Yeah, it's a lovely spot, and you're away from the riffraff, and so is the ocean. So the ocean out here is really pristine. Doesn't get affected by any of the farming effluents coming off the land or anything like that, which is other countries are experiencing seaweed dying because of a lot of the land fertilisers coming off and creating a lot of problems.
So that isolation of the Abrolhos, which is what makes it tricky to get to and tricky to live on, is also what makes it ideal for this.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's perfect. And, you know, it hasn't been an easy road working out how to grow this stuff and getting it to look like this, but the weather out the Abrolhos Islands is not very friendly, as you can tell.
No, it's howling a wind outside.
Yeah.
Actually growing it,
yep.
What's that process been like in terms of learning the best way to cultivate it, that sort of thing?
It's been pretty cool. It's for me, normally diving underwater is looking for fish or looking for other stuff, and I don't do that now. I don't see anything. I don't see fish. All I see is varieties of seaweed, and I've learnt so much underwater. It's pretty cool. It's like a big underwater garden. And after 4 years of diving, looking and getting seaweed, you sort of work out, hang on a minute, it's not growing so good here, and it only works under that amount of light and under that amount of coral. So you sort of work out, okay, this is how you've got to grow it, and it doesn't happen overnight.
Abrolhos Island seaweed farmer Ash Sutton speaking to Joe Prendergast. Sonny Feldhoff, would you have seaweed lollies?
I'd try them. I'm not a big fan of licorice, and I'm guessing the saltiness might make it a bit licorice-like.
He sort of made it sound like it tastes like red frogs. So.
Oh, well, then I definitely eat them.
I'd be intrigued to see whether you get that seaweedy taste in that. Anyway, what's coming up on your show?
Well, we are talking, I guess there's a sort of lolly link there. What's happening with our Christmas pageant this year? In the last 2 years, it's been at Adelaide Oval. Will we see things change? I'm guessing because I'm bringing it up, we might. We're going to find out from on that front. And if you noticed hovering ahead during the night, we'll explain where that noise is coming from.
Oh, I did
from.
Hear that last night.
Exactly.
I was intrigued. Well, keep listening to ABC Local Radio. Tonya Feldhoff has lots more coming up. It is coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.